I started to turn away, but he added, "Is this really happening?"
"What's that?"
"Is this real? I mean, is there really $1 million that's really mine?"
"As near as we can tell, yes."
"I'm honestly not feeling very well."
He studied me for a moment more and then added,
"I just need a few more minutes."
I nodded. "Well, whenever you're ready, but take as much time as you need." He closed the door and I walked back down the hallway and rejoined the conversation. I told her she could have it if it had a complete roll cage.
"Shit, I forgot about the roll cage."
She stared at me for a moment and then turned and started out of the bank, I assumed to cross the street to our offices to order a roll bar. Wes watched her go and then turned back to me.
"You realize you're creating a public menace?"
"I don't have final say. That's up to the county commissioners."
"They're not going to tell you no, Walt."
"They tell me no all the time." I glanced toward the restroom again. "Ever had this big of a response?"
He glanced at his wristwatch. "No, not this much."
"You think I should check on him again?"
He adjusted his glasses and shrugged. "Like I said, I never had anyone have this long of a reaction."
We both walked down the hallway and I knocked again.
"Mr. Townsend?"
No response.
"Bass, are you all right in there?"
Wes and I looked at each other and then I tried the door, which was locked.
"Mr. Townsend, if you don't answer, I'm going to have to break the door down."
I listened, but then looked at the banker.
"Do you have a pass key?"
"No." I put my shoulder into it and felt the jam break apart. Townsend was lying on the floor, gasping for breath. I kneeled and felt the pulse at his throat and watched as his eyes fluttered. He looked up at me.
"I was sick, but then my chest started hurting, and I couldn't catch my breath."
"Does your chest still hurt?" He nodded, and I turned to Wes, standing in the doorway. "Get us an ambulance."
"He's fine. It was a mild coronary blockage, aggravated by the agitation which might have caused an arrhythmia."
Standing with Isaac Bloomfield in the hallway of Durant Memorial Hospital, I was holding my hat and feeling a little guilty. I guess we didn't think that telling someone that they'd just inherited $1 million would give them a heart attack. The old concentration camp survivor smiled, pinching his lower lip with an extended thumb and forefinger. "Medically, it was bound to happen. Unfortunately for you, perhaps, but fortunately for him, it happened on your watch. He's resting peacefully, and we have him on a mild sedation to allow him to regain his footing. Do you know of anyone we should notify?"
"Not that I'm aware."
"When will I be able to speak with him?"
He shrugged one shoulder.
"Possibly an hour, possibly a day. But he's in no danger. Not at this point, I don't think. I mean, he had an episode, but I think he'll be fine."
David Nickerson came out of the room and approached us.
"He's asleep, and all his EKG readings are good. Does he have any genetic propensity?"
Isaac nodded. "His grandfather, the one we did the autopsy on, was a victim of cardiac arrest, but there were mitigating factors such as his age."
"Anything more on that?"
"Not really. As I said, it appears that he had some sort of injection the night of his death, but the toxicology report came back negative. There are some elements that might remain in urine or blood samples, but I suppose we'll never know because such samples don't exist."
"What kind of elements?"
"Oh, speaking hypothetically, sux, for example."
"Sux?"
"Succomethonium chloride, part of the rapid sequence intubation protocol, which would include respiratory support, but he's been used by some clever murderers in the past."
Nickerson snapped his fingers.
"The guy in New Jersey?"
Isaac nodded.
"And Florida?
They now have acquired the detection abilities in tissues and biological fluids to pick the stuff up, but you would need a urine or blood sample prior to death, which we don't have."
The younger doctor glanced back at the door where Bass Townsend was comfortably resting.
"Perhaps we should do a little further testing just to be on the safe side?"
"Possibly."
They both looked at me.
"You're going to have to take that up with Mr. Townsend."
Slipping my hat back on, I turned to head toward the emergency entrance. "You'll let me know if there are any changes in his condition?"
They both called out the ubiquitous Wyoming response.
"You bet."
When I got to the curb, Vic was waiting for me in her soon-to-be-retired unit.
"Get in."
I leaned against the door. "If you're going to show me why you need a new unit, I'm not getting in this vehicle."
"No, we got an emergency call from the Soldiers and Sailors Home."
I climbed into the nest she called a vehicle, pushing empty soda bottles, notepads, books, and fast food wrappers to the floor mat. What's going on? Vic jetted out of the parking lot, took a right, and then made the next right onto 4th Street, winding through cars with her siren wailing and lights flashing a Morse code of "Get the hell out of my way." What's up? Somebody broke into Charlie Lee's room.
Good grief.
Buckling my belt, I braced a hand against the dash in hopes of mitigating the impending crash. Why are we in such a hurry? Passing two cars on the left, she rocketed back into our lane, barely avoiding an oncoming semi whose horn rattled my fillings.
Police business.
When did this happen? How should I know? Carol Williams called and said that the room had been broken into and that you might want to come up and take a look. Once we'd barreled past the edge of town, I watched as she swerved around a slow-moving pickup and veered into the entryway of the veterans' home, the four men in their wheelchairs waving as if this were an everyday occurrence. Roaring past the first parking lot and the administrative offices, she turned the corner and slid sideways to a stop in the no-parking area in front. I glanced up at the bumper sticker-covered window on the second floor and could have sworn I could see someone's shadow quickly disappear. Vic threw open the glass doors and charged in as Country Joe McDonald strummed his guitar and warbled, "I feel like I'm fixing to die," from the speakers above.
"Are you coming?"
Breaking from my reverie, I turned and glanced at Vic and rushed after her as Carol intercepted us in the lobby. "It's okay, it's okay. I've got the room blocked off."
"When did it happen?"
She walked along ahead of us. Must have been very early in the morning. The night man made his rounds at around 3 and didn't see anything, but the morning man spotted the door on his first pass. We arrived at room 124, and it was obvious somebody had used a crowbar or something similar to pry open the heavy door. Looks like a professional job. Vic slipped on a pair of plastic gloves that she had taken from the kit in her unit and pulled the door open, which revealed an even greater mess than the one that had been there before.
Cripes!
Looking over her shoulder, I could see that all the piles of books and magazines had been toppled over, and the artifacts had been swept from the shelves. Somebody was looking for something. I glanced around the room at the walls, but none of the hanging art was damaged. Nobody could have done this quietly. Carol peeked in. The men on either side are medicated at night, and the rest in the area are pretty heavy sleepers.
Was Charlie Lee medicated?
She entered and made her way to one side, standing by the door to the bathroom, with the sack of books still sat on the toilet.
No.
Isaac says he might have had an injection the night he died.
She waved her hand before her nose.
He mentioned it, but there was nothing on the charts.
Did you have all the books cataloged?
I can't be sure, but it doesn't look as if anything had been taken. She glanced in the bathroom.
God, that smell. I'm going to have to let housekeeping get in here.
I scanned the room. Why in the world would somebody come in here and dump the books over and...
I caught something that appeared to be out of place. Stepping over the collapsed stacks, I found an empty section of floor where the built-in elongated closet door hung partially open. Taking a pen from my pocket, I slipped it through the handle and pulled the door the rest of the way open. There were a few items hanging there, including Charlie Lee's dress uniform, topped by a shelf for his hat, and a remarkable ball cap collection, mostly military-themed. There were a few dress shirts that had been knocked to the floor of the cabinet. But what caught my eye was the back of the closet, where a faux wood panel had been pulled away. Curious, I reached in, took the items that were still hanging from the support rod, and handed them back to Vic. I gripped the panel, which popped away with ease, and then carefully turned it sideways in order to remove it from the closet. Reaching my hand back to Vic, I stuck my head inside.
"Give me your mag light."
She did as I requested, and then leaned in to watch as I shined the beam onto the open back, where the drywall was chipped away to reveal a space about 14 inches between the studs in the wall. Turning the beam upward, I could see that there was a hidden compartment that broke through the ceiling where the sill wood had been carefully chiseled away in a circle that continued upward.
"What do you think is up there?"
I turned to look at my undersheriff.
"Nothing."
"Nothing?"
"Nothing now, but I'd be willing to guess that if you rolled up a 9.5-foot by 14.5-foot canvas, it would fit in this little cubby perfectly."
She looked back at Carol, who stood near the bathroom door.
"Are you telling me there was a $24 million painting propped up in this closet the whole time?"
"Possibly." I watched as she stepped into the bathroom and reached for the toilet handle. Don't flush that.
So who took it?
I wish I knew. As she drove away from the veteran's home, I thought about it. As near as I can figure, Charlie Lee had only one thing in his life that could have been worth $1 million.
A $24 million painting?
Yep.
Do you think he sold it?
Possibly. I thought about it. Selling a $24 million painting for $1 million? Of course, it's difficult to sell one that was presumed destroyed and in possession of the 7th Cavalry Headquarters, a branch of the United States military, and, in proxy, the United States federal government.
They have a lot of lawyers.
Yep, they do. Watching the rolling scenery go by, I was momentarily mesmerized by the glimmering sun reflecting through the quaking leaves of the trees like vibrating $1 million bills. I looked past the brick sign and the chiseled marble that made up the entryway to Fort McKinney, and at the four wheelchairs parked by the road. Stop! She glanced at me.
What?
Stop! She locked the brakes, and the aged SUV slid to a halt as I flung open the door, circled around the hood, crossed the sidewalk, and stood in front of the waivers. The old serviceman looked up at me in mild surprise as I stood there and studied each of them in turn. Army Command Sergeant Major Clifton Kaufman was going light today with an outlandish Hawaiian shirt, but the ubiquitous boonie hat still covered his crown. Kenny Cade, Chief Petty Officer, was wearing a blue T-shirt with a blue-nosed polar bear emblem I recognized from my time in Alaska. Air Force Master Sergeant Ray Perdue was still peering at me from under his cap with the scrambled eggs on the bill, and Delmar Pettigrew, the oversized Sergeant Major of the Marines, was still holding down the far right with the everyday attire of satin jacket and red cap. I continued to study them and gave them a moment to study me as I slowly took off my sunglasses, summoning as much of my former commissioned officer as I could muster. Kenny was the first to clear his throat.
Can we help you, Lieutenant?
I waited another moment and then delivered the word slowly. Custer's last fight. They stared at me, their eyes collectively widening a bit. Clifton had a coughing fit, and now they were looking at one another before allowing their eyes to come back to me. We stood or sat like that for a few more moments before Navy summarily pivoted in his electric wheelchair and drove off down the miniature rolling highway that led back toward the home. Army followed suit, along with Air Force, which left me staring at my comrade in service, Marine Corps, when he suddenly turned and followed after the others. Watching the diminutive convoy disappear over the hillocks, I became aware of Vic standing beside me.
So, you want me to shoot out their tires?
Chapter 10. I can't see, but in a way I can see more clearly than ever before. There are small swirls and swipes, muted patterns, brushstrokes of mostly browns and greens, with figures darting from all sides under a flat sky with waves of heat on a July high plains day. There's dust, and there are noises, screaming high and loud, not all of it human. I've got my hand around another man's arm where a cuff of some kind embraces his bicep and some sort of bone breastplate strains across his chest. Dark with dark features, he's wearing some sort of headdress, but it's a strange one, and the orange feathers on top make it look like his head is blooming. The heat, the dust, and the noise are so oppressive that I feel like dropping back and resting in the high grass that overlooks the river in the valley below. But he's moving, and I watch his other hand as it rises up, blocking out the sun for just a moment, and I'm almost glad for the shade. He hesitates, and our eyes meet, joined in disbelief. There's a stone club in his hand, the clear tawny sinew, the red paint on the river rock, and the delicate feathers that flitter a rainbow of color in the sun. Then, with all his might, he brings it down into my face.
Earth to Walt. Come in, Walt.
Hearing her voice in the distance, I turned in what seemed like slow motion as the images faded and disappeared.
What?
She leaned back on the bench that rests on the bridge, spanning Clear Creek. She sipped her soda, her unfinished grilled cheese sandwich, lying on the wrapper in her lap.
I'm so glad you're not having those spells anymore.
Taking a deep breath, I stretched my neck muscles and listened to the popping noises.
How long?
About 2 minutes. I'm sitting here chattering away, and I look over, and you're staring off into the ozone. Did Doc Bloomfield say if this was supposed to go away?
He didn't.
Well, at least they're getting shorter. She continued to study me. So, what was this one?
I think I was at the Little Bighorn, or in a painting of the Little Bighorn.
She nodded. Were you an Indian?
I don't think so.
Well, then this one ends badly. She sighed and stared at me. So I'll repeat my most recent question. Did Charlie Lee sell the painting, and did the purchaser come back to retrieve it? And if so, why trash the place?
Huh?
For the third time, did Charlie Lee sell the painting, and did the purchaser come back to retrieve it? And if so, why trash the place?
I tried to concentrate. It is so hard these days.
A warning?
To who? Charlie Lee is dead.
I leaned forward, rested my elbows on my knees, and listened to the rushing sound of the water beneath us as the twilight shouldered the sun to the west. We sometimes got our dinner to go from the Busy Bee Cafe, only 20 yards away, and then ate it on the bench to avoid the summer crowds. Maybe they were frustrated when they couldn't find it. Or maybe they were frustrated, and then they did. Dog sat beside her, or more important, beside the remains of her sandwich, adjusting his weight as she regarded him. I'm going to give you some, but you have to wait.
Who in the world has $1 million in cash to throw around?
The federal government.
It's their penny, so they don't have to buy it.
She picked up her sandwich, but then paused, mid-bite, to look at me. Are you going to call in DCI to dust the place?
I'm trying to decide if they have better things to do.
$1 million worth of better things?
I know, I know.
How long are you going to sweat the Joint Chiefs of Wheelchairs up at the home?
I haven't decided yet, probably till tomorrow.
They're going to be trying to get their story straight.
Yep.
Hey, how come there aren't any Coast Guard guys up there?
Most are under 6 feet tall and drown when their ship sinks and they try and walk to shore.
She stared at me. Sorry. Old Marine joke. So the next time there's something really important, I'd rather not have you or Wes tell it to me. Capiche?
I thought we were relatively gentle in the delivery of the information.
He had a heart attack, Walt.
Bloomfield and Nickerson said he was heading in that direction anyway, and that we just exacerbated the condition a bit.
No way he was up at the home looking around. I turned to glance at her. Hey, everybody's a suspect until we catch someone.
I leaned back on the bench and smiled at some tourists on their way to the bandstand for Dave Stewart's bluegrass night.
No, he was waiting on the steps of the office when I got there and then supped over at the Blue Gables. You sure?
I called Jim at the office. He said Bass checked in, went to his cabin, and didn't appear till morning when he came out and ordered a cappuccino.
Lucky for him, he's staying in the only place in the state of Wyoming that has such a device.
She handed the rest of her sandwich to Dog, and we watched as he swallowed it in one great snapping gulp.
Jesus!
She checked her fingers to make sure she hadn't lost any.
It's like the shark tank at SeaWorld.
He doesn't have very good manners.
She stood and took a few steps toward my truck. So, what's the game plan?
I guess I have to call DCI. We haven't got much to work with since I let the most important piece of evidence be stolen.
Well, we know it was the real deal, that's something.
I stood up and we walked along Main Street until we got to the truck, where I opened the rear door so that the beast could jump in. He sat on the sidewalk looking at me, just to make sure I wasn't fooling him by uttering the word ham. Get in, it's not a trick. I glanced at Vic. He's got a memory like an elephant.
She reached out and battered his nose. Get in, you moron!
With the possible exception of Henry and Ruby, I figured Vic was the only one who could get away with that, and then watch as he jumped in. I closed the door and had started around the truck, when I noticed she wasn't getting in.
I stopped at the front fender and rested an elbow on the hood between us. What, I have to beg you to get in, too?
Are you happy?
I laughed until I saw the seriousness in the tarnished gold eyes.
What? Are you happy?
What are you talking about? She rested both forearms on the hood and placed her chin there, studying me.
Are you happy? It's a simple question.
What is this all about? She set her eyes on me for a good long while and looked very serious. It was more than a little unsettling.
These fits that you're having, where you just go away, are you sure it's not something simple like maybe you actually want to be somewhere else?
I thought about it. I don't think so. I mean, it's usually not a pleasant experience.
She looked down the street. You'd tell me, right?
Tell you what?
If something was wrong?
I studied her until she finally turned to look at me. Yes, I would.
Cool.
She pushed off the truck and started down the block at a saunter.
Hey, you don't want to ride?
Nah, I'll walk.
She paused and considered the goods behind the plate glass of one of the stores as I studied her reflection.
You do the same for me, right?
She stood without moving and then finally turned just enough for me to see the side of her face.
Have you ever known me to hold my feelings in check?
The sly smile held for a few seconds, and then she walked off, the Glock bouncing on her hip as she checked the door of every shop on Main Street to make sure they were locked. Watching her until she turned the corner at the end of the block, I finally opened the door and climbed in, turning to look at my companion. Next time, just get in the truck, okay? Doubling back, I took the left and then another left, parking in our lot and letting Dog out. I unlocked the door to the office and allowed the beast to go up the stairs to Ruby's chair first. I didn't bother to turn on the light, but picked up her phone, called DCI in Cheyenne, got an answering machine, and, after telling a shortened version of the situation, requested its assistance in fingerprinting a room at the Soldier and Sailor's home. It was about then that someone picked up the phone, and I recognized the voice of Steve Woody Woodson, the director.
You're kidding.
I wish I were. Stuffing the phone into the crook of my neck, I glanced around.
Why'd you get the big dog if you called DCI during off hours? Nobody else is here, and I was walking by the reception desk when I heard a familiar voice.
Did you say $1 million?
I did.
And something about a Custer painting?
I did.
I'm getting in my car and heading up there right now.
Woody, wait. I mean, you can wait till tomorrow.
This is the most interesting case I've heard of in years, and I'm not letting anyone else have it. Whatever you do, don't call the field office in Sheridan or Gillette.
I'm not calling anybody else, Woody.
How's the fishing up there this season?
I knew there was an ulterior motive in all this.
No, but if I'm driving all that way, I might bring a rod and wet a fly or two.
I'll call the Ferg and get you the lowdown.
He's still working for you?
Retired. I think law enforcement was getting in the way of his fishing.
I understand perfectly.
I hung up the phone and glanced around at the graceful cursive writing on the assorted notes, forms, and papers that made up my dispatcher's desk. I'd heard that they were going to stop teaching cursive in schools, which is fine with me because then all of us old people would have a secret code. I was about to get up when I noticed that Dog had walked to the end of the counter and was looking toward the main entrance. He stood there a moment more and then approached the edge. There was a gasp from the entryway and then a voice,
"Oh, my God!"
I stood and walked to the end of the counter and grazed my fingers on his back to let him know I was there and then peered over the edge to where what appeared to be a woman in a hoodie stood plastered against a glass door.
"Howdy?"
Putting the hood down to reveal her blonde hair, Katrina DeJean looked up at me and sighed.
I thought I was a goner there for a moment.
"Only if you were a ham. Can I help you?" She smiled. "Katrina DeJean from the Buffalo Bill Gala?" Taking a few more steps, I sat on the edge, and Dog went down to greet her properly, with his tail in full wag.
"I know. Is there something wrong?"
She petted Dog and came up the steps, stopping a few down to look me in the eye.
"What? A girl can't just stop by to see the sheriff?"
"Sure, but it's after hours."
I saw your truck and thought I'd try your door.
While we're here, is there something I can help you with?
This is going to sound odd.
Okay.
There was a notice on one of the social media marketplace sites about a lost set of rings that were found.
I thought about the report Sizer Bertori had given me a few days ago, and I was sure that, as tech-savvy as he was the one who had posted it. An engagement set.
I think they're mine.
Really?
I came through Durant a few days ago on my way to Cody and stopped in a parking lot on the way up the mountain, and I think I lost them there.
Can you describe them?
Better, I can show you a picture.
She held out her phone, turning the screen to show the self-same rings on her own hand, or at least a hand similar to her own with the same fingernail polish.
Sure looks like the ones that were found. Oh, thank goodness. From what I am to understand, they were quite remarkable. Almost $30,000 worth.
That's remarkable, that's for sure. Mind telling me how it happened?
I threw them away. I was angry.
$30,000 worth?
She crossed to the side, resting her back against the railing and spreading her hands on the steel. I don't suppose you've ever done anything stupid like that?
Daily, actually.
I was mad at the individual who gave them to me. A nat-